From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. That was the sound on the Senate floor last night when Arizona Republican Senator John McCain voted, no, you could hear a little gasp there, on the so-called skinny repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
Senator McCain clearly surprised some Republicans who thought they had the votes to pass. Vice President Mike Pence even arrived at the Capitol just in case he had to cast a tie-breaking vote. He didn't. McCain joined two other Republicans, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine, and all the Senate Democrats in voting down the bill. That effectively ends Republicans' efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare. This was the sound outside the Capitol last night when the news broke. Actually, it was about 1:30 this morning.
Well, joining us now, Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent. Hi, Tam.
Hi.
And Maria Elena Salinas, news anchor at Univision. Hi, Maria Elena.
Good to talk to you.
And let me start with you, Maria Elena. I mean, what do you think of this defeat? People are describing it as a major defeat for the Trump administration and for Republicans.
Definitely, it's a blow to Trump and Republicans in Congress. But John McCain did the right thing. He put country over party. Once again, he has shown that it's not just about winning for the sake of winning, but, you know, taking into consideration the consequences of the vote. How will it affect the American people? Not just how will it affect my reelection bid? You know, there's a reason why he's called a maverick. So now this will probably force Republicans in Congress to actually work with Democrats to make changes on the health care law, because after all, Democrats also agree that changes need to be made. You know, but as long as both sides want to make this a political win, we won't get anywhere. And the ones most affected will be the American people, those who they represent.
And Tamara Keith, what do we know about why John McCain voted as he voted?
Well, so what we should say is that what the Senate was considering was called the skinny repeal. And so it was not something that basically any senator wanted to become law. It was sort of this Hail Mary, last chance, like we can't agree on what we want, so let's just come up with some sort of vehicle that would get us into a conference committee so that then we could work it out maybe later with the House. But there was a concern among some Republicans, including John McCain, that the House would just take up this so-called skinny repeal and make it the law. You know, if the House approved it, it would be over. There would be no conference committee. There would be no negotiations. And McCain had been raising concerns all along about how this was done behind closed doors in a very partisan fashion. It was done through this process known as reconciliation, which meant that no Democratic votes would be needed. But it also meant that just three Republican votes could kill it. And that is ultimately what ended up happening. Though we should say that, you know, don't write the obituary yet, necessarily, that they could still come back and try again.
You know, that's a very logical explanation for it, Tamara. But some may also look at the things that President Trump has said about John McCain and say he's getting his revenge.
Well, and also John McCain, as we all know, has brain cancer,
right?
And doesn't have years and years left. He probably doesn't have to worry about running for reelection. It is reported, though we haven't been able to confirm it ourselves yet, but that John McCain spoke to President Trump last night, and that President Trump reassured him that this skinny repeal wouldn't become the law, but it simply wasn't persuasive, nor was the lobbying of Vice President Mike Pence that happened right on the floor of the Senate last night.
So, Maria Elena, you alluded to this a few minutes ago. Is this the end of the Republican push to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act?
It looks like it is the end, at least for Republicans. You know, this is definitely a political move. And I think that now they have to work together. Now they realize that that it's not going to be Obamacare turning into Trump care, that it has to be some kind of health system that really helps the people, that lowers the premiums, like they say it will lower the premiums, but not at the stake of having millions of people be left without health care. And I think this is going to make them stop, pause, and think about this. I mean, what is this law all about? Is it really only about winning for the sake of winning, or should we really dig into it and see what we're doing or what we can do to help? Because let's face it, a lot of the senators said that they were voting without really knowing what they were voting for, or that they didn't even know what this bill included. So I think this is a good pause to just sit back, read it, and figure it out in a bipartisan manner.
All right. Now, I know that the next thing we're going to talk about is two stories ago, but we still need to talk about what just happened with the new White House communications director, Anthony Scaramucci, having this late night conversation with New Yorker writer Ryan Lizza and slamming the White House chief of staff, Reince Priebus, and the chief strategist, Steve Bannon, using offensive descriptors that we won't repeat on air. If people haven't seen it yet, right? I mean, you can go and look it up yourself. But Tam, what's going on, and how are people in the White House and in Washington reacting to this today?
So the things that Anthony Scaramucci said in that interview are not suitable for work and certainly not suitable for the radio. Remarkable things. And beyond the sort of graphic language, also basically saying the chief of staff is on his way out and you know, I'm going to fire everybody, which is pretty remarkable for a guy who's been on the job 5 days,
right,
and isn't actually even officially on the job. But Reince Priebus is the current chief of staff, who is on an island. He's like a man on an island, and his island keeps getting smaller. And he doesn't have a ton of responsibility at this point. Like, for instance, Anthony Scaramucci, the communications director, reports directly to the president, not to the chief of staff. Typically a chief of staff in the White House would, you know, bar the door of the Oval Office and control who gets in to see the president.
But is this what it's going to be like from now on with Scaramucci? It's just this kind of drama every day?
Oh my God.
Yeah, go ahead, Maria Elena.
Yeah, and if I can just jump in, we have to be careful not to make this the new normal. I mean, there's been several times after Trump goes on a Twitter rant that we say that what he's saying is below the dignity of the presidency. Well, now the level of dignity and decorum has hit an all-time low, and we have to be very careful not to accept this. If Trump says nothing and this continues as if nothing happened, then we turn it into the new normal, and that's completely unacceptable. When I read that yesterday, I thought, you know, this is embarrassing. This is embarrassing for all of us, for the American families. You know, what are our children going to think of the presidency now when they hear him, people in the White House saying this type of thing? But I was also thinking of the media around the world scrambling to try to translate into their own language the things that this man said. And, you know, that is really, really embarrassing.
It also strikes me that I think every radio and TV station in America is going to have to get out the automatic beeper just in case when Anthony Scaramucci is on. So one other thing this week, the president kept his attacks up on the attorney general pretty much daily, Jeff Sessions. Here is the president answering a question about his confidence in Sessions earlier this week.
I told you before, I'm very disappointed with the attorney general, but we will see what happens. Time will tell.
This doesn't seem to be going over well with a lot of Republicans. As we mentioned earlier this week, Sessions is actually actively enacting Donald Trump's agenda in many ways. Can you both weigh in, including Maria Elena, how about you, in terms of the president's attacks on Sessions, how they are reverberating in the Latino community?
Well, you know, it's surprising that even though Trump goes after anyone who disagrees with him or becomes an obstacle for him to get his way, you would think that he would hold back with someone who has been such a close ally. As you know, Jeff Sessions is not a friend of the Latino community. He's probably one of the most anti-immigrant people in Congress. When he was in Alabama, he did it. He always supported SB 1070, which was a law in Arizona that was also very anti-immigrant. So it goes to the extreme right when it comes to the immigration issue. So he's not necessarily a friend of the community. But at the same time, I think everyone is shocked at the lack of civility that there is in this White House. You know, this just proves that there are no sacred cows in the Trump world except for maybe his family members. You know, even his friends and allies are subject to the wrath if they get in his way. You know, if he's unhappy with this attorney general, why not just fight it out with him if he wants to? But to publicly ridicule him on Twitter, it just makes no sense. It just cements the idea of a dysfunctional administration.
Well, Tamara, what happens now with Jeff Sessions? I mean, has he won this battle by the fact that Donald Trump hasn't fired him?
Jeff Sessions is putting his head down, doing his job, and waiting to be fired if he is fired. He basically is saying, as other people in the administration who've also been sort of on the hit list have said, you know, I'm here to serve as long as the president wants me. So that's sort of his status, and he, you know, he's nowhere near the president today, even though the president is going to New Jersey to talk about, you know, a crackdown on the MS-13 gang, right, which is something that the attorney general should be there for and proud of.
You know, well, ironically, he's in El Salvador. He went to, right, so they're on the same issue, but in completely, you know, they couldn't be more separate. Sessions is in El Salvador dealing with the, right, issue of MS-13, and now Trump going to New Jersey.
Just it avoids an awkward
Washington
conversation.
Right. Well, Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent, and Maria Elena Salinas, news anchor at Univision, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And
thank
as
you.
Anthony Scaramucci would say, no, never mind. I won't do that. It's here and now.
What's it like to be smuggled into the United States? There are lots of ways to do it, and most of them are dangerous. Earlier this week, 10 migrants died after they were trapped in the back of a sweltering tractor-trailer truck in Texas. Our next guest has his own story of coming to the U.S. Melvin Caballero was 16 years old when his family paid a smuggler to bring him to the U.S. from Honduras. We spoke with him yesterday about his journey and why he left his life in Honduras in the first place.
Life in Honduras was very tough. We didn't have much time to go to school. Me and my brothers, we had to help my parents to, like, pick up coffee to, like, to support the 14 of us because we have a big family.
So it was a difficult life, presumably for all of you. What made you decide to leave?
Two of my older brothers, they had already made the trip to the United States, and they will send money back to my parents. That encouraged me to see, like, a better future for me and my family.
So that's a big decision for a lot of reasons, leaving your family behind, also because you were not going to come here in the legal way.
Yes.
You had to find a smuggler to bring you. So how did the smuggling happen?
So they came to my house. His name was Poloncho, the smuggler. And he talked to my dad, and they planned everything. And a day after, like around 6 in the morning, I remember, the smuggler came to my house. That was a sad moment, just leaving my mom behind, leaving, like, everything I had. That was very hard. I just left with the hope that I was going to the United States to search for, like, a better life. At that time, like, I was so innocent that I didn't know what I was, like, getting myself into.
Melvin was taken across Honduras and into Guatemala and had to spend several nights in what was supposed to be a safe house, but it didn't feel safe for him at all.
So there was like 5 bodyguards, and they were armed, and they were drinking. Now I know that they were like using cocaine and stuff, but at that time I didn't know what they were doing. A little bit after, they would start like turning crazy and like yelling at each other, arguing, and then like shooting. So it was scary, and like we had nothing to defend ourselves.
Was there any violence?
There was a lot of violence there. There was a girl that was dragged. One of the guards was calling her to go to another room with him. And she was like, she didn't want to do it. So the guard, he took out his gun and he started pointing at all of us and like saying, oh, if you don't come with me, I'm going to start killing you. And in my town, we don't have like electricity. So I never seen it, neither in movies, that people like could have the capacity to kill somebody else. And so he started beating the girl, like punching her in the face and dragging her to the other room. And like an hour later, the girl came back crying, like with all bruises on her face and blood. And a lady, she asked the girl, like, what happened? And like, she wasn't even able to speak. She was just crying there.
What happened after that?
One day, they didn't give us food. The next day, they brought us food and we were able to eat in the morning. The second day in the afternoon, they started doing the same thing, like drinking. And like, they started like also like raping women, like taking them to the other room and like, I was, like, afraid because I didn't know, like, I was a kid. I didn't know how to defend myself.
So the next day, a bus shows up. You take the bus, then are let off somewhere outside of Chiapas in a very rural area of Chiapas, Mexico. You have to walk 3 hours, and then you're given the opportunity to make the final trip into the United States of taking a train or a tractor trailer.
Yes.
And you guys decide to get on the tractor trailer because the trip is a lot shorter.
A lot shorter, and we believed that it was going to be less dangerous.
So describe it.
So around 9 p.m., we all got inside the truck. There was about 120 people. And near the cabin of the truck, there was like a small hole that people were able to like to breathe.
To breathe. To breathe. You mean that was the only window?
That was the only window.
That led to the cabin of the truck where the driver is.
Yes.
In the front.
So they put children and women near the where they were able to breathe, and then all men were like in the back of the truck.
Was there anything in there? I mean, any chairs or anything?
No, there was like animal feed, like the sacks of animal feed, and then we were on top of the sacks.
And so I imagine it was very dark?
It was dark, even during the day, and extremely hot. My whole experience, like coming to the United States, everything like was difficult. But like riding inside the truck was just devastating. We didn't have water. All they gave us before getting into the truck was like a small bottle of water, and they told us that the water was supposed to last for the 5 hours that we were inside the truck. So there was like three or four bodyguards inside the truck with us, the migrants, and they told us that if we needed to pee or if we needed to like defecate, we could drink the water from the bottle, and then we could pee like in the bottle. So we wouldn't like mess up the animal feed. And they said that if anybody did it, the person could easily be killed. And time was passing by, and it seemed like the 5 hours were gone, and like we're still inside the truck. Nobody could do anything. They were like, they had machetes and they had guns, and like we couldn't do nothing to like start protesting against like the cruelty that we're facing. They had food, they had water, and even though we wanted some, they wouldn't give us any.
So what were you thinking at that time? I mean, you're 16. It sounds like you anticipated none of this going in. What was going through your mind?
It was so hot inside. The atmosphere felt like disgusting. Like you couldn't breathe. As time was going by, everything was just becoming worse and worse. So we, inside the truck, we spent about 36 hours.
36?
Hours inside that truck.
And you think that was intentional? They told you it's going to be a five-hour trip.
Yes. So basically they lied to us just to get us in. I reached it to a point that I felt like I was going to faint. And there was a point that I just asked God to like just kill me because I couldn't deal no more with the suffering.
You wanted to die?
I wanted to die. I couldn't, like, me myself, I felt that I couldn't breathe. I felt no air coming inside me or out of me. And looking at the devastated like gazes of the other people was just extreme.
Eventually, you got to the Rio Grande. Did everybody survive that trip?
I have no idea. When finally they opened the doors of the truck, they just told us to run. When I came out of the truck, I ran. So I don't know if everybody made it alive to the point when they opened the doors.
You had to cross the Rio Grande. You were told to swim across. What was that like?
Once I started getting into the waters, I was afraid. I knew how to swim, but looking from one side of the river to the other one, I wasn't sure if I could go across. Once I was like in the middle of the river, I started feeling like the currents of the water that were stronger and like the water pulling me down. And like me, I just remember myself praying to God that I didn't want to die in there. And somehow I reached the American side in Texas.
You reached it. What was that like?
For me, I thought that once I crossed the river, I'll be safe. But it wasn't like that.
What happened?
So once we all crossed the river, we started walking, following the two guides. And we walked all 9 to like 6 in the morning. And then the next day, they told us that we had to cross the desert. In the morning, they gave us one can of like tuna fish, one can of mixed fruit, and like a can of beans and a bottle of water. So with those supplies, they told us that we had to be able to cross across the desert for 3 days. And at night, when it was dark, it was like the time to walk. So we made it across in 5 days. for me, the hardest part was not having water to keep moving.
How'd you keep going?
I mean, I see everybody, like, struggling. There was a lady that was coming with her child, and she was left behind. The smuggler, he kept bringing the child, but his mom was left behind. Mm. And I didn't want to be left behind like her. So I don't know how or where did I get the strength to keep moving. I just did it.
Melvin did make it across the desert. He and the others got into the smuggler's SUV for the rest of the trip. But 10 minutes before they reached safety, he heard sirens. He and the others were arrested, and Melvin found himself in a detention center in Texas. While he was there, he was able to call home to Honduras and find out that a family friend in Boston was offering to sponsor him. So Melvin headed north. He got temporary protected status to stay here legally, and eventually he became a citizen. We wondered if he'd do it all over again, given the challenges he faced along the way.
Many times I have thought about this. I felt that everything that I went through was worth it, but if I have to do it again, I don't think I would be able to take that proposition.
Just one final question. Do you understand the concern of people in this country about who's coming in legally, who's not coming in legally, the concerns about immigration and national security?
I mean, I understand everything that's going on. It's just that for many people in the United States, immigrants are like just coming over to take our jobs. Immigrants are coming over and then they are taking over the United States. What they don't know is why do we do it? Like, they don't know the situations that we are facing back in our countries, the lack of food, the lack of education, the lack of health. We do it because we see it, that we have the opportunity in this country. I used to not talk about my story, about my life, my experience, because I felt that I was going to be judged by people. But now I feel that I need to talk about this. I feel that I need to put my story out there so people can know what it takes to be an immigrant. I'm proud to say that I am an immigrant, and I'm proud to say like how I came to the United States and what it took me to make it to this point.
Melvin Caballero, thank you very much for talking.
Sure. Thank you for having me here.
This spring, Melvin graduated from Bridgewater State University and got special national recognition for his work on immigration. He also just got married.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle, and it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first 3 meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
We learned this week that Coke Zero is going away in the U.S. It'll be replaced with something called Coca-Cola Zero Sugar. NPR food and health correspondent Allison Aubrey joins us. Allison, tell us about the new Coke Zero and how it's different.
Well, you know, I think the new name says it all. Coca-Cola Zero Sugar. It really emphasizes exactly what's not in the product, sugar. And this might be a smart move at a time when sugar has become the nutritional demon. I mean, the company's being a little secretive about exactly how they're tweaking the taste. But I reached out to them today and they told me, you know, it's still the same artificial sweetener that you have in Coke Zero now. It's aspartame and Ace K. But they're saying that they are, quote, optimizing the unique blend of flavors to give it a real Coca-Cola taste. So how's that for marketing?
I mean, marketing is important here because it comes at a time when soda sales in general have been declining. Is the hope that this relaunch of Coca-Cola Zero Sugar, that it's going to help?
Well, I think so. I mean, what's clear here is that this relaunch of Coca-Cola Zero Sugar really fits with what Coke's new CEO, James Quincey, has been saying since he stepped into that role, that, you know, given consumers' changing taste preferences away from full-calorie sodas, that the company is really going to focus more on its low- and no-calorie options. As you point out, sugary soda drink sales have been sagging. I think earlier this year, Beverage Digest reported for the 12th straight year that soda sales had fallen. stolen. So I think the bottom line is that consumers just have a lot more options, and a lot of people are going for the low-calorie or no-calorie, you know, teas or waters.
So this is just about consumers changing their preferences?
Well, I think it's more than that. I mean, I think the industry is really feeling the pressure from obesity researchers, from public health experts, who point to the consumption of sugary drinks as one of the dietary habits that's really fueling the epidemic of obesity. I mean, the soda industry has not turned a blind eye to this. The American Beverage Association, which represents all the big soda companies, they say they want to be part of the solution to addressing obesity. And they've made this commitment to marketing more of these lower calorie, lower sugar options.
But what do we know, Allison, about the health value of these low sugar, low calorie options?
Well, you know, it sounds like it should be an easy question to answer, right? If you cut out sugar and sugar has a ton of calories, that should be good for our waistlines. But here's the thing, a pretty big review, a scientific review came out earlier this month looking at lots of studies that have been done on this question and concluded that there's no evidence that consuming drinks made with aspartame and sucralose, all of these artificial sweeteners, helps people manage their weight. One example was the San Antonio Heart Study. It found that there was this strong link between diet soda consumption and weight gain over time.
But it's hard for people to know exactly what to do if they want to have a soda. Even the World Health Organization is telling people to cut way back on sugar.
Right. I mean, I think the only safe thing to do would be to just drink water all the time. Here is the reality check, Jeremy. One study found to burn off a 250-calorie sugary soda, that's many calories is in a 20-ounce soda, you'd have to run about 50 minutes or walk 5 miles. And if you talk to public health researchers, they say, you know what, best thing to do, cut them out.
Yeah, I've seen a side-by-side comparison of a cup of coffee and a soda, and the amount of spoonfuls of sugar you'd have to put into your coffee, it would be crazy.
Piling it up. That's right. That's okay. Right. So I'm going to stick with my seltzer water here.
Yeah, good idea. NPR food and health correspondent Allison Aubrey. Allison, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Army forces in Afghanistan may be losing their grip on Kandahar province to the Taliban. This week, Taliban fighters stormed a military base outside Kandahar city. They killed at least 24 Afghan soldiers. That's according to the Afghan Defense Ministry. The attack has raised fears of a new offensive by the Taliban. The BBC's Alia Atrafi is in Kabul. Alia, would you give us some context here? Because 16 years ago, the U.S. and its allies invaded Afghanistan, eventually ousted the Taliban from the government there. But the Taliban still controls parts of the country. I wonder if you could tell us how close the Taliban is now to taking its former seat of power in Kandahar.
We spent 4 days with the Taliban a couple of months ago, and they say that's, you know, nearly 90%, because it has had a strong man in the name of General Razik, who has had a firm grip on the security situation in the province. Otherwise, if we go to other provinces such as Helmand, Uruzgan, Zabul, it's believed widely that if not for the American warplanes, the Taliban could have easily taken these provincial capitals.
You're saying that if the U.S. presence was not there, and if U.S. warplanes in particular were not there, then more or perhaps all of Afghanistan would be in the hands of the Taliban again?
A lot more. At least that's the understanding on the ground. And that's the reason why I believe there's a strong feeling in the Afghan government and a strong hope that the U.S. Government will support the Afghan government with the air power. That's making all the difference. It's improving, but they feel that they need a lot more support from the U.S.
Alia, remind us what the Americans are doing there, including using the air power, but also there are 8,800 American troops right there right now. President Trump has given our defense secretary the authority to send more, something like 4,000. That hasn't happened yet. But what is the American role and what are U.S. troops doing?
One believes mainly it's the advise and support role, but one believes that in the future there will be more and more engagement on the ground.
Why does it seem that the many Afghan troops, some of which were trained by the United States and its allies, why are they not able to push back the Taliban? What is the weakness there?
It is believed that the main factor in Taliban succeeding and in the government losing its territory is corruption. It is believed that say, military personnel or civilian governors, they purchase their positions in Kabul, and then they have to make that money back. And the person paying for that, the bill, is the civilian on the ground, the poor farmer. And it's creating a winning ground for the Taliban. The human terrain is provided for them for free.
The Taliban itself, how does the Taliban of today compare to the Taliban the United States and its allies ousted previously in its doctrine and in its goals?
That's a very important question. So the new Taliban, for a start, they are more moderate in a way, and also they are taking advantage of government weaknesses. For example, when there's corruption in the government, they make sure there is no corruption, less corruption amongst their circles. You know, when there is lack of security, they provide more security. And also, they don't bother with small things anymore. They don't bother with your short beard or with your long hair. So a far shrewder bunch of fighters who are trying to now learn to govern in a way imitating the Afghan government, you know, something that the previous generation failed in.
The BBC's Aulia Atrafi in Kabul, Afghanistan. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling me, Lisa.
The CEO of the Boy Scouts of America apologized last night for the political rhetoric of President Trump's address to the Scouts at the National Jamboree in West Virginia this week. During the speech, the president attacked what he called the fake media and touted his November victory over Hillary Clinton. At one point, he got the Scouts to boo President Obama. In an online statement, the Scouts' Michael Serba affirmed the group's commitment to respect a variety of perspectives and to stand up for individual rights. That variety of perspectives is in evidence in Ohio. There's a new scout troop there that may challenge some assumptions about the typical Boy Scout. Tony Ganser from Here and Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream reports.
Give me a couple stones. I tell you what we're going to do. Give me a couple stones.
In a patch of woods east of Cleveland, about a dozen boys and troop leaders are getting ready to build a cooking fire, trying to use stones not covered in ants.
You know, welcome to family.
And trying to remember what it takes to build a fire and then light the fire.
Then just go and put that under the paper.
This is the first time Troop 2690 has come together for a kind of crash course in scouting since forming this month. What makes the troop pioneering, in a sense, is that it's the first troop chartered to Northeast Ohio mosques, or masajid. Isa Abdul-Mateen is the scoutmaster.
I think everybody has the preconceived notion that the Boy Scouts are Christian-based. So you kind of like feel like, you know, if I do become a Boy Scout, then maybe I can't be myself. Then I found out that, yes, we can be ourselves, and that was, like, attractive. So here we are. Yeah, Muslim Boy Scouts.
Let's go. Fire,
when you put them on, guys.
Scout troops can be sponsored or chartered by all kinds of organizations, including nonprofits, churches, synagogues, or mosques. Three Cleveland-area mosques have contributed boys to the troop, including the Muslim Association of Cleveland East, or MACE. Mohammed Samad helped organize the troop, which has mostly African-American members.
There were some members of the community that never even thought about the Boy Scouts because it was always looked upon as not only a Christian, but to be quite frank, a lily white organization that wasn't open to a diverse group of people, okay, and especially for the Muslim community.
When you have a knife, you hear it called different things, the blood circle or the death circle or something like that. No one should be nearer you.
Part of this first outing included learning about knife safety from a professional scouter with the Lake Erie Council and carving sticks to cook bread twists on the fire.
Easily, then you know it's cooked inside because the dough's not sticking to it.
Mohammed Samad says it took patience and someone not giving up on this effort to finally form the troop and fill a need.
There was nothing for the Muslim community on a regular basis for the young boys. So I had always thought that the Boy Scouts, which already had its organizational structure, was a good resource to reach out to.
Nobody's going to get good bread if we all jam it in there.
Boy Scouts of America has more than 5,000 scouts who are Muslim. About half of those are in the more than 100 troops chartered to mosques, according to the National Islamic Committee on Scouting. Cleveland troop organizer Mohammed Samad says a big part of the appeal of scouting was its emphasis on faith and the 12th point of the scout law. A scout is reverent.
All right,
duty to God, being reverenced towards God and towards the earth and fellow human beings. So it kind of is a perfect opportunity for us to take advantage of the Scout organization, okay, and emphasize with these young men how Islam is very similar to what the Boy Scouts is trying to do.
I think it's a good experience because I really like doing outdoorsy stuff. And I was really looking forward to it, like, right when my mom told me.
It's really fun. Like, we get to play games and do a lot of activities and stuff.
Junaid and Numair are two of the boys helping to build a fire and cook the bread twists covered in jam. They're two grandchildren of the scoutmaster, Isa Abdul-Mateen, who admits this troop may raise eyebrows for some.
You know, I can tell now because we're the first troop. It's going to be like Muslim Boy Scouts? I guess what we have to do is be ourselves and not try to be, you know, anything other than who we are. And people can see us for what we are and what we do, and you'll see an acceptance.
Mateen says xenophobic or Islamophobic rhetoric is just propaganda. And perhaps this troop could be an icebreaker to changing opinions.
Anytime you can take a group of people or a religion and damn it without knowing about it, then that's your problem. You have to understand. And once you understand what we're all about, then it's almost like, you know, you would love to be a part of us or even want to help us.
So like any Boy Scout troop, this group will seek out community service projects and aim to do a good turn daily. And Mateen says once people see what the troop does and how they interact with other scouts of any religion or background, he thinks any negative reactions will change. For Here and Now, I'm Tony Ganser.
The HBO comedy Insecure debuted its second season on Sunday night. The show stars Issa Rae, the show writer and creator, as a fictionalized version of herself, a black woman living in L.A. Here's a clip in which Issa explains what it's like to be the only black employee at the nonprofit where she works.
I've been here 5 years and they think I'm the token with all the answers.
Let's just ask Issa. Issa, what's on fleek?
I don't know what that means. I know what that means. But being aggressively passive is what I do best.
Joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
Well, tell us more about Issa's character.
Yeah, so she plays this character. She's very awkward. She's somebody who's trying to find her life, her way in life, like so many millennials are. And, you know, she is working for this nonprofit. She's not sure it's really making a difference. She cheated on a long-term boyfriend that she had in the first season. And as this new season begins, she's trying to strike out on her own and figure out whether she wants to get back together with him or do something new. Now, the thing that's always present about her is that she's very awkward about things in life, and she expresses it sometimes through rap lyrics. She'll look at herself in the mirror and rap about what she's feeling. Hmm. And I think we have a clip to sort of show how that works out for her.
Go, shawty. It's my birthday, but no one cares because I'm not having a party because I'm feeling sorry for myself.
Everybody can relate to that.
Yeah. I think I've even sang something to that before. But Insecure came out of Ray's web series, The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl. She adapted the project for TV when HBO picked it up. How has it evolved from that?
Well, it's interesting because I talked to Issa last year, and she insists that Insecure is not a version of Awkward Black Girl, that this is a separate and distinct project. But when you look at the first season, you see bits that were lifted directly from the YouTube series. Like one of the things I loved about the YouTube series is that it just showed a scene where she was walking down a hallway at work and she had to pass somebody, a coworker that she didn't know that well. And how awkward is that? And we've all felt that, right? So,
yeah.
You know, and then they recreated it in the HBO series. Now, as the second season begins, I think we see the show move further away from the stuff that she did as an awkward black girl. And we're seeing, you know, a much more layered and complex depiction of black female friendships, of millennial black culture, of black romance for millennials, but it's revolutionary because it's black characters. Because so often on television we see black characters and they're extreme. They're either amazingly successful or they're amazingly victimized. To see average young black people living their lives and negotiating black culture, white culture, work culture, romance culture, that's something we don't get to see all that often.
Now, she's the first black woman to create and star in an HBO program.
Mm-hmm. And she's only the second black woman to create and star in a comedy ever.
Well, what do you think changed or what is changing in the industry to make room for something like that if it hasn't happened yet?
Well, there's a few things. First off, I think there's a thirst for new voices and there's a thirst for new stories. And so, Issa Rae has been on the radar in Hollywood for a long time as someone who has a unique voice and is funny and compelling. And HBO, it took HBO a few years to figure out how to assemble a creative team to work with her to really make the show successful. And it's to their credit that they did that. Also, I think we're finding that there's a hunger for diversity in television. People know that there's a diverse world out there. They want to see it reflected in their TV screens. And finally, I think the TV industry has recognized that black consumers have a lot of power. They disproportionately watch more television than white consumers. And indeed, HBO's audience is something like 22% black. So they know they have to create some shows to service that audience because it's a loyal audience at a time when people are cutting the cord and people are going away from cable. Black folks and black women in particular are still watching television. You need to create shows that speak to them.
So if it's so great, Eric, and it's so revolutionary, how come it didn't get any Emmy nods?
That is the question of the moment, my friend. And I think a lot of critics were scratching their heads. I think the simple answer is that there was a ton of competition in the categories that she would have been nominated in. And beyond that, I think the show is still kind of an under the radar kind of thing. I mean, it's so weird because, I hate to make a weird allegory, but a lot of times we only talk about things that are related to black folks when we're talking about how black people have been victimized or have been held back. Mm-hmm. And now we're talking about Insecure because it didn't get Emmy nominations and because people seem to be overlooking how good this show is. It is really great.
Well, I will have to check out Insecure. Eric, you'll be happy to know that I have started The Handmaid's Tale, which I know you're a big fan of. And
I almost drove up to Boston and made you start watching it. So.
It's great. And I also just finished The Keepers on Netflix, which was a great documentary as well.
Oh, my God. Yeah, really great documentary. That's the thing. When you look at the Emmy nominations, and we said this before, there's just so much great programming out there. So sometimes we have to have a little talk about a show like Insecure so we make sure people don't sleep on it.
Right.
And maybe next year she'll get the nominations that she probably should have gotten this year.
That's Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic. Eric, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.